Welcome, everyone, and thanks for joining us for the second in the series of our New Horizons events. We decided, you know, a couple of weeks ago to put on this series of events to, you know, provide us with an opportunity to share knowledge and sort of help, you know, ideas and experiences as we all look to sort of manage the present situation as best we can and then also plan for the future. And we're doing this in association with our podcast series, which is called Without Borders. And I've got to say that I'm Brendan Craig, I'm the managing partner of Taito. And I'm joined by my colleague, Flick Hazelhurst.
Hello. Hi, everybody. Thanks so much to everybody for joining live this afternoon. It's great to see so many people here. Just a note, though, that if you're not able to join any of the events going forward, we will be broadcasting them on our Without Borders podcast regularly each week as well. That can be accessed at our website, which is taitopr.com, or alternatively, you can find it on your favourite podcast platform. So we're on Spotify, iTunes, just look up Without Borders and you can find us there.
Excellent. And so today's discussion is on the subject of authentic optimism and a growth mindset. And we are joined by Simon Clarkson, who is a mental skills coach for one of England's top Premier League soccer teams or football teams, depending on what part of the world you're joining us from. But he also does a huge amount of work with sort of management teams and teams. He's someone actually that Taito's worked with on a number of different occasions. So it's fantastic to have you with us, Simon. How are
very
you?
Very pleased to be here. Very pleased to be here. Yes, good. Thank you. Considering the circumstances, very good.
Yeah.
It's very different and very new, but also presents lots of opportunities at the same time. So.
Yeah. And I think I'm someone that's, I'm kind of like a bit of a football fan myself. So I've always been able to kind of like draw a lot of wisdom from, you know, sports and just how managers and teams work. And I think there are a lot of, similarities with how we, you know, work in business. So I think it's no surprise to me that you work on both sides of the fence, both, you know, with a football team and also with, businesses.
Yeah, it's fascinating actually, because a lot of people, I think there is the presumption, therefore, that the majority of the time it's businesses that want to learn from how elite sport works and how elite sports and organisations and teams work. But I find it fascinating that working the other way around as well, there's sort of more enlightened people within sport really want to actually learn from how business works as well. There's a lot of things that business gets right in terms of, you know, things around, say, structure, for example, and process and things like that, that sports teams are very, very keen to understand and learn from.
Yeah, so there's a lot
of going both process. Ways.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. So me and Flick have got a few questions for you, but also I wanted to invite people that have joined us also to ask questions. So if you'll see like a Q&A button. So if you have questions for Simon as we go through, add them there. And once we've got to the end of our questions, we'll turn to you and see if we can get through as many of those as possible. But maybe just to, you know, kick things off, Simon, what do we mean by authentic optimism? I know a lot of us are kind of like, probably if you're anything like me, you're having like a bit of an emotional roller coaster. Some days you're like pretty, you know, depressed about the situation and the constraints around us and, you know, seeing obviously lots of people struggling and things. And then other days I'm quite up because I kind of see the challenge and, you know, it's sort of like, and try and see things as a challenge. But what do you mean by, what should we mean and understand by authentic optimism?
Well, I guess there's a few different ways of describing it, but the easiest way is almost to think of a phrase that you may well have used yourself, or maybe people listening that might either have used it themselves or will know of others that have said it. That sort of famous phrase, I'm not a pessimist, I'm just a realist. Mm. So you've ever heard that. And I guess there's always this conscious choice. And I think there's certainly a bit of a British thing behind that sort of a phrase as well. I think it is quite a cultural thing in the UK as well. At the same time that the British seem to assume, I think that the majority of people in other parts of the world tend to be more optimistic than we are. But you can almost think of it as three things: that we do have pessimism, and there is such a thing called false optimism as well. Mm-hmm. And authentic optimism is really just that balance between the two. So it's can you be optimistic but realistic at the same time, instead of having to say I'm not being a pessimist? And there's different ways that people process information at a cognitive level, and how we process that information will sit us in one of these different categories. The truth is we all do a little bit of all of them. But there are ways and means to try and get ourselves into that nice balanced area.
Yeah. So it's kind of not overemphasizing. It's kind of like having a proportional outlook to the constraints that you're facing, as opposed to kind of seeing things as being even worse than they are.
Yes. I think there's really two things, and this was written about a few years ago now as well, and there's something called, and a few people may have heard of it, called the Stockdale Paradox, which was named after Colonel James Stockdale, who was a POW in the US Navy or Air Force, I can't remember which, forgive me for that. But he was asked, as a war hero and as a leadership kind of guru, he was asked, who did you see as being kind of mentally strong or not, as the case may be? And he said, well, the pessimists, they really struggled. The people that kind of process the situation as they're never going to get out. It's this is terrible. They can't cope with this, and so on. But he said, but the false optimists, they also really struggled. The ones that thought it was going to be some kind of holiday camp, or that they were definitely going to be home in 2 weeks' time, and that they were actually glad to be out of the jungle because this was going to be better for them, you know, 3 square meals a day, and you know, at least they were dry and there wouldn't be bullets ringing around their ears every couple of minutes. But actually that was just as dangerous in terms of people's mental health and their actual physical health, ultimately, it seemed, as pessimism itself, because they were consistently disappointed and surprised in a negative way about the reality of the situation. So what Stockdale said, he came up with this idea of you need to face, and he called them brutal facts, because obviously in his situation, they were relatively brutal. But he said, you've really got to face the brutal facts, but face them in a way that helps you to, with regards to mindset and beliefs, to understand that they can be overcome or they can be dealt with in different ways. So that kind of balancing act, that you, if you don't face the brutal facts, then those facts will be the things that actually ultimately end up getting in the way. Yeah. So it's a realistic view of the world around you, but at the same time, viewing it in a way that helps you cognitively to process those facts in a way to do something about them, as opposed to feeling like you're enslaved by them.
Yeah. Basically. So thinking about the current situation, I think for a lot of people, maybe you're running a business, or your job is kind of like, you're struggling to do your job in a difficult environment. It's going to feel a bit like you're a Premier League footballer and your team has lost 3 to 5 games on the bounce. So, yep. You know, it kind of feels a bit like that sometimes, doesn't it? You know, cause it has been a challenging few weeks. How do you remain positive in that situation? And what kind of advice would you give to people that are, you know, having a bit of a tough time of it at the moment?
I think probably the quickest way to thinking about it is, and I saw a friend of mine actually shared a slightly different way of thinking about this recently, but we talk a lot within sport and within football as well, about controllables versus uncontrollables. Interestingly, I was actually, I was very, very happy to watch last week with Bea Ghaffari, and she talked a little bit about that as well. The way that we process information, if you think about it from the point of view of how a pessimist would process information, they tend to think about all of the things that are uncontrollable. So they obsess about the uncontrollables. And they even actually go a step further. So they think about some of the things that you can either control or at least influence. They tend to think of those things as uncontrollable as well. Yeah. Whereas actually, when we're being authentically optimistic, falsely optimistic doesn't face up to the facts. They just, as we already talked about, but when we're being authentically optimistic, we tend to obsess less about the uncontrollables and think about, well, what can I influence and what can I control? And there'll be a varying degree of obviously both of those. So first of all, there's what's controllable. Secondly, when one of the things that we talk about. So therefore, with regards to how do you keep people positive, it's thinking about controllables. So a big part of that will be therefore focusing upon performance as opposed to results where possible. It's really difficult, actually, that when, you know, with elite sport, because clearly it is, ultimately, it is about whether you win or you lose or you draw. But in terms of actually how we then talk about a performance afterwards, it's about trying to focus as much as is possible upon performance as opposed to focusing purely on the result, whilst also understanding that the result is driven by the performance ultimately.
Is that link into the other theme that we were going to pick up on around having a growth mindset? Is that kind of like, what does that, you know, maybe you could explain what having a growth mindset means and the relevance of these two things together?
Well, and they are very, very closely related to each other, basically. And the easiest way to kind of describe a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset is that a fixed mindset believes that our level of capability or ability is fixed in some way. So therefore, and I guess you could almost kind of therefore look at that with regards to very kind of natural talent point of view, that you have a certain degree of natural talent and your skills and your capabilities can only get to a certain level. And there's not really therefore very much point in pushing when you feel like you're not going to be good enough in order to be able to achieve something. So it's very much achievement based. You either achieve it or you don't. Whereas what a growth mindset focuses upon is that you're not chained to your current capabilities, that actually with a shift in mindset and a shift in the way that you think, you can actually impact your own skill level or capability level and improve that over a period of time. It doesn't mean you'll necessarily win or lose. It doesn't mean you will achieve X or Y, but it means you will be able to make progress. And that's a huge thing, I think, at this moment, in terms of leadership and in terms of coaching, when it's difficult to understand, because it's difficult to achieve whatever it might be that we're setting for ourselves, but to understand at the end of the day, how much have I progressed? What have I actually driven in terms of progress? And that's very good for our mental state as well. So even within football, and from my experience of working with, you know, really good coaches and really good a really good manager, that they'll tend to focus much more upon progress and performance, whilst ultimately also being very careful not to ignore the fact that the result is obviously there. Just take on it. The other thing that's quite interesting is when you think about from a statistical point of view, just specifically with regards to sport, statistics can be used in lots and lots of ways, and you'll see, more pessimistic view. You can look at statistics in this pessimistic way or actually an optimistic way. And a pessimistic view on a set of statistics is when somebody's on a losing run. Well, they've lost five in a row, they're on a bad run, etc. Okay. Whereas actually you could look at that, and statistically speaking, this is going to sound a bit strange when I say it this way, but hopefully it makes sense at least on a simplistic level. But the more that I've lost in a row, then in theory, the nearer I am to my next victory. So that's a very simplistic way of looking at it. It doesn't quite work like that. But actually, there's no reason why the next game should be completely determined by the first. So that's where we start to get, it gets a bit more technical, where what really good coaches and leaders do is they separate the next performance from the last one. They look for the positives in progress and performance, but they also have to face the brutal things that they need to do better. That's the authentic side of optimism, but then treating the next as it owes you nothing, which is a phrase that the manager at the club that I work with at Burnley Football Club uses very regularly, that it owes you nothing. It's the same with a winning run, because there's almost a lazy perception that can take place sometimes, that when somebody or a team are on a winning run, that they're great. It takes no energy to win the fifth or sixth time. And clearly that's not the case. No. The next one, you have to put as much effort into that as well. So it's about treating them in a singular way. So every day is different, every quarter is different, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. I mean, I recognize a lot of the things you've said in myself in terms of worrying about things that you can't control, and probably a kind of, like, maybe obsessing about them, or rather than actually focusing on the things you control. I think I recognize but thinking about these two things, having an optimistic, authentically optimistic outlook and a growth mindset, from a performance perspective, what sort of difference can that make? Like, in, you know, is that, can you be 10% more effective, 20% more effective, or, so, you know?
Well, percentages are difficult to quote, right, clearly. But what I can do is quote really robust studies from much more learned people than I.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's another, I mean, in terms of growth mindset, Dr. Carol Dweck, who literally wrote the book on that. I mean, you know, the term was coined by her, a fantastic book called Mindset. Actually, I advise anybody to read it. There's lots and lots of really robust examples of studies that Dr. Carol Dweck and her team did. Going back even further than that, there was quite a famous study that I read about from somebody called Martin Seligman, who's a professor of psychology over in, I think, Pennsylvania. And he tested the US Olympic swimming team, and he was able to actually measure the optimism and pessimism levels of different individuals within the team. Without going into lots of detail, because you could spend a lot of time kind of sharing the anecdote, but essentially what they found was when they manufactured a false disappointment or a false sense of disappointment or failure by actually, well, as far as I'm aware, literally lying about a time that a swimmer had just completed, so giving them a slightly slower time than they had swum, they found that the people that scored more on the authentically optimistic side of Seligman's scale, they found that they actually improved their time the second time they were asked to then get in the water after having, say, 15 minutes rest. The people that had scored on the pessimistic side, so, for example, people that focused on the uncontrollables, there was a couple of other parameters as well, actually. Yeah. When they got in the pool the second time after having been told of this time that to them would be a perceived disappointment or failure, just like getting a bad sales number in or a piece of news that you weren't expecting in a negative sense, what happened to their behavior and performance is that it actually dipped. And what they found was, statistically, the further you were along this scale either way, the bigger the difference in the times was. So I won't try to quote the times, but it was, the relationship was proportionate, and it was fascinating to read about that as well. So so whilst I can't really talk about percentages, there's a directly proportionate relationship.
So it sounds like, specifically, if you're in a moment of challenge, that if you're authentically optimistic,
drives behaviours.
Yeah,
definitely. That therefore would give you a much better chance. No guarantees, but will give you a much better chance of actually driving a different result. So. Yeah. Again, that comes back to this concept of performance versus result, because you can't control the result.
Yeah.
You can only influence the result through your performance level.
Yeah.
And you can, control is an interesting word, but you have more control and influence certainly over your own performance level, most definitely.
Just on that though, I think sometimes we feel in business that it's the result that kind of keeps the momentum going and keeps us wanting to push forward. It's the feeling of kind of being on that journey and working towards something. At the moment, the world feels very much like it's at a standstill and that we're not working towards anything and that we perhaps feel like the momentum is lost a little bit. So how can we maintain motivation and momentum at a time where it feels like there's none?
It's a really, really good question. And I think, I guess there's probably, well, two answers that I would have anyway. And with all of this, you know, I'm not pretending to be the oracle. There's lots of, you know, very clever people that write about this. I study it, really. But I guess there's two things. So one is having a very, very clear view of the future further down the line, so that everything you're doing now, when we goal set, you know, and we can goal set in lots of different ways. I talk a lot about the neurophysiology of goal setting and how actually having a really clear picture of a future state as a result of good quality kind of neuro-friendly goal setting is really important in terms of driving behavior. So there might be a little bit of having to shift out those timelines with regards to therefore thinking about the behaviors and the performance that I'm driving now and how that's going to affect me. But it might have to be more how it's going to affect me 6 months down the line or 9 months down the line. So, you know, for anybody in a small business, you know, at this point in time, maybe you're shifting your goals to the size of your pipeline for September, October, or November, as opposed to thinking about your quarter end this quarter, because again, that's therefore facing those facts authentically, that the quarter end may well be less within your influence at this point in time, but maybe your pipeline for Q3 or Q4 is absolutely within your influence. Mm. That doesn't take away some of the shorter term problems that might cause, and we'd have to deal with those in a different way. Another thing to think about is having, it's going to sound like I'm actually going to say the opposite thing now, but also having little mini goals,
yeah,
almost on a day-to-day basis of okay, so, but not thinking about them as such a binary, I've completed that or not. So actually thinking about a goal as being, how have I progressed X or Y? And being able to almost tick off progress at the end of a day. And again, from a mental well-being point of view, it's quite important. At the most important time of the day, when we're just about to go to bed and go to sleep. So a couple of times I've spoken to people over the last couple of weeks and said, well, you know, keep almost a diary of progress that you're making on your task list, as opposed to just ticking off whether you've actually completed it or not. Because there's a lot of things that are kind of up in the air about not being able to complete it. So that's two. The final thing, and I'm conscious of a lengthy answer, but there's a process of what's called mastery, where we get into a state called flow. A really good writer in this field, Dan Pink, wrote about this in his book Drive, and it's a well-known concept, very clever kind of psychologist, Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi, I think he was called, wrote about it as well, where when you get into, and I don't know whether you've ever, you will have experienced this, you will definitely have experienced it, but when you get into it so deeply lost in a task is probably the only word I can think of, but all time just seems to slip by, right? And so you're actually very much in the present tense, as opposed to thinking and judging yourself against things as to whether I'm going to do it by X time or by Y time or not. And when you're in that state where you lose track of time and you kind of look at your watch and it's midnight, and I often get that with hobbies, for example, but I do get it with task focused stuff within my work as well. We suddenly go, my goodness me, it's midnight. I need to go and get some sleep. And you've been at it for 3 or 4 hours and not even realized, because time's just flying by and you're in what's called flow, where the task is enough of a challenge that it stimulates you, but it's not so much of a challenge that it scares you to death.
Yeah.
So it's about trying to find, and that's called the Goldilocks zone, it's called, because it's just right. It's not too big. It's not too small. It's just right. And when you're in that zone, you're at your most motivated and you find the most amount of energy to complete tasks in that zone. So that's a really good thing to think about in the present tense as well.
It kind of makes me think about, and apologies that my football analogies might not be as good as Brendan's, but it makes me think about when football teams have to play off for third and fourth place in a football tournament, and actually they're not going in for that big prize, but they've still nonetheless got to motivate themselves to go and play that game well and do as well as they can in it. Is it the same kind of psychology in terms of how they motivate themselves to get on the pitch and perform well for a game like that?
So I think in some ways, yes, I guess, but you've still got a controllable, I guess. The thing is with that, I suppose, what you could then start to introduce and start to think about is, what do your deep-rooted sort of core values tell you to do? You know, even if you can't get the result, and think about that on an average quarterly basis. You know, if there are many times in a quarter where somebody, you know, perhaps they're not going to hit their target, and perhaps with a few weeks left, they know they're not going to hit it really. So the foot comes off the accelerator slightly. I mean, it might be a bit of a cynical view of the world, but you know, the cynical view might be because actually what's happening is they're perhaps saving a little bit of it for the next quarter or whatever. But the non-cynical view is there's nothing going to come in, so I may as well actually just wait and take the break. Whereas actually, you know, thinking about one's sort of more deep-rooted values as to what drives my behavior, as opposed to just thinking about whether it's I get the result or not. If I've got a value of you know, absolutely never giving in, or say, for instance, always giving 100% or whatever it might be. And there are ways of working on developing those values over time as well as an individual. Really, when it comes down to that, I'm going to quote other people here, without the extrinsic motivator of winning the game, which I guess in a third, fourth place playoff is still an important thing for people, but it's just perhaps not as important as winning the final. Or, well, definitely not as important as that. And the disappointments obviously affected them. What it then comes down to is, well, what do I stand for? Or what do we stand for? You know, who are we really? And how does that drive our behavior? And that's more of an intrinsic motivator, which is what you really need. You need to tap into the intrinsic motivation rather than the extrinsic motivator of, you know, winning that deal or or winning that football game or whatever it might be. And actually, in the long term, whether it's a losing run or a winning run or third place playoff or whatever it might be, the more that you can tap into the intrinsic motivators in the first place, the better the results will ultimately be. Mm. Because actually that's where even more motivation and sustainable motivation really comes from.
And actually, I
just said that's well written about. Dan Pink's talked about that. There's lots of people that have written about that as well.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, because actually I was just going to ask you about coping strategies for staying resilient when things do go wrong. And actually that idea of really tapping into your internal values and using those as your guide, I guess, is one, really.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you would talk about in terms of how the kind of coping strategies we can use at the moment when it feels like things are certainly not going quite right?
Yeah. So I think there's a number of kind of simple physical things to do. I think from a cognitive point of view, there is this concept of how you are perceiving and processing the things that are going on around mm-hmm. you, and how you face these facts around you. Do you face them as we talked about before, are you seeing them as uncontrollable, there's nothing I can do, or are you seeing them as controllable? Another two kind of ways to think about that is, do we overgeneralize or do we look at the facts in a much more specific way? So Seligman talked about that as well, in terms of, you know, we can, you know, something can go wrong and the immediate thought process can be, well, the whole world's just, you know, it's a disaster, there's nothing I can do about it, which makes it uncontrollable. And then we also make it permanent as well, mm-hmm. in a way that we think, which is saying it's never going to change, it's never going to be the same.
Yeah.
Okay. Which might actually be true, and some of that might be a good truth in the long term, that it may never be the same, which, I know that's a difficult, it's a kind of a strange thing to say. But I've had a couple of clients who've talked about the fact that there are certain things that are happening at the moment for them in the way that they're now having to work that have actually overcome some problems. Don't get me wrong, they didn't want this to happen, and it's not turned out to be an overall positive for them. But they're talking about being very, very careful that when they go back, what they don't want to do is go back to the old norm. They actually want to take some of the positives out of what's happened. So one example for them was that it's completely broken down silos within their business, because there aren't any anymore. Because everybody's in the same situation, they're all looking at a screen, we're all working from home. So they have an office in London, let's say, an office in New York, and an office in Paris, let's say. It's no longer people in Paris saying, well, it's those people in London, or people in London saying, well, it's those people in New York. At the moment now, there just isn't any of that, and everybody's kind of doing it together. So,
yeah.
So they want to take, well, how do we therefore make sure that we don't go back to sort of really siloed working afterwards? So, but on the
That's
opposite
really,
side,
yeah. Sorry, you go. I was going to say that's very interesting, because that was the way our business runs, on a completely remote model, and we have a team that spans multiple European countries. And one of the sort of byproducts is that no one feels like everyone feels more connected. So ironically, from being remote, you know, I always have this sort of expression of like when everyone's remote, no one feels remote. It's interesting to think about all of the different positives that can come out of a very challenging situation.
And that's just from a business point of view. And there's some simple ones, which I know there's a lot of noise around this on, you know, all you need to do is go onto LinkedIn or Instagram or whatever, and there's all sorts of stuff around it. So I'm not suggesting that this is groundbreaking or anything, but just, you know, thinking about the opportunity that it presents. I mean, that's very growth mindset. If I sort of think about my example, the nature of my work means that I travel I did travel all the time, right? So the obvious upside for me at this point in time, there are lots of downsides, don't get me wrong, and there are some very big downsides. But if they last a long time, will require certain things for me to do in order to be able to deal with them properly, which, you know, but I can already be working on those. But there are also some upsides. I mean, my 12-year-old and my 9-year-old, you know, I'm getting to see them more than ever. I'm getting to see my wife more than ever. One really, really good upside, which made me giggle the other day to myself, was my son, as he woke up in the morning, said to me, what are you doing today? I said, well, I've got some calls in the office. And so as in my home office, I've got some calls I'm doing. I've got this. I've got to write this report. I'm making a video for a client, blah, blah, blah. And he said, "Wow, I just didn't realise you work so hard." So, well, that's because normally I'm working from a hotel room somewhere. Yeah. And you get to see it. And so
you're getting appreciated.
I'm getting probably appreciated a little bit more. I think little simple things that you can do in order to try and cope. And I've seen this called lots of different things. So just a really simple little example is keep a little diary of progress that you make before you mention that. There's also something that I've heard called a few different things, but even a gratitude diary.
Yeah.
The way you, and I'm not talking writing War and Peace. I'm just talking about two or three or four little bullet points at the end of a day in a book that just, you know, things that happened that day or progress you've made that day or an event that took place or just a funny moment or whatever that actually you go, you know what, that was great. And again, at the most important time of day for your stress levels to be going down and therefore anxiety to drop and therefore for you to be able to sleep, you know, just a little bit of appreciation and gratefulness is important.
Yeah.
Final little thing, be careful. Be careful the amount of news you watch in the evening.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Just be careful what you're kind of exposing yourself to in terms of catastrophizing and making these problems bigger than the, you know, and so on. We need to know what's going on clearly. But then that's, again, this balance of authentic optimism. It's got to be authentic. We've got to understand what's happening. But at the same time, there's a very close member of my family. Go on, I'll say who it is. It's my dad. And he just is obsessed with watching the news. He watches it and he just watches it on a loop. And I say to him a number of, no wonder you know, you're more anxious about this than anybody else is. Because he's just consistently feeding himself, you know, information that, okay, I'm not suggesting it's false information, but at the same time, does he really need to know it 20 times a day?
Yeah. No. I was going to say on the, thinking about some other positives, I think just on a personal level, it's, you know, as you manage a situation like this and you run a business, it's a really good opportunity sort of to pause and think, okay, when we come out the other side of this, how do I want my business to kind of to emerge and to you know, what's the shape of my business in the future? And I think it's a really good opportunity to kind of pause and take stock on that. And then I think on a societal level, I think what's great is that we're now appreciating people for jobs that previously we didn't appreciate. So whether that's the people working in the supermarkets or people working in our hospitals or the delivery people that are making things, keeping things going, you know, there's a lot of appreciation for people that in the past we took for granted. And I think that's another real positive, I think, to come out of the current
Most definitely. I think coming back to your first point in terms of as an opportunity to think about where you want your business to be in, say, 6 months' time. It's if you kind of, I know that it doesn't, the point about authentic optimism, it doesn't solve all the problems now, and we have to clearly deal with those. But almost thinking about this in a slightly different, you know, some people call it a paradigm shift, and there's lots of different ways of explaining it. But just thinking about the situation differently and thinking, right, well, okay, if I was going to start a business in, you know, say human performance, right, or human performance development, and I was going to start it in 6 months' time, how would I want it to look? Because if I've got 3 months or 6 months, then I've got an opportunity to be able to shape the business in that way.
Yeah.
And that's also very motivating at the same time.
So I think just thinking, moving on to a slightly different subject. I think at the moment, like anyone who's running a business, you're always kind of slightly conscious of the fact that things could be a bit different month to month. But at the moment, it feels like things could be a bit different day to day. You know, that you're dealing with a level of uncertainty, which is very hard to, like, to get used to and sort of to get your head around. How, just from your experience of working with sort of elite sports people and athletes and things, how do they plan for uncertainty? And are there any things that we can draw from that to help us, like, cope with the level of uncertainty that we're currently facing? I think when we chatted before, you were talking about how people, you know, maybe have to sort of think about scenarios
certainly. Yeah, I think there's two things. So I think one definitely scenario planning is really important because people don't deal with uncertainty particularly well as a whole. Okay. Uncertainty is a from a psychological point of view is not generally very welcome for people. It doesn't mean that we can't. It just means that we've got used to not dealing with it particularly well. So one way of trying to create some, not certainty, but some sense of a plan around uncertainty, because we can't change the fact that there is some things uncertain, is to just do some simple scenario planning, as you say. There's two great examples of that I can think of just sat here now. So in 2011, the All Blacks won the World Cup. There was a lot of pressure on them at the time because they'd failed to win the World Cup at a number of attempts when they'd been the favourites, and they were playing, I think, in New Zealand at home. So I think there was a lot of pressure on them there as well. And they famously did a lot of scenario planning around, and the All Blacks do a lot of scenario planning, as a number of teams do. So I'm not suggesting that they're the only ones, but it's just a good example. And as I understand it, they lost their star player, or one of their star players, a guy called Dan Carter, either just before the tournament or in the first kind of group game or something. Mm. And everybody was, oh, here we go again, they're now not going to win. They had scenario planned for if they lost him, as well as a number of other players. They'd also scenario planned for if Dan Carter's second string was then lost. Mm. I forget the name, or forgive me. They'd scenario planned for that as well. And how would they do that? How would they cope with that? What would the strategy be that they would put in place? Which doesn't necessarily, as you say, guarantee a victory, but it gives them some sense of, if X happens, then Y will be how we react to that. So it gives at least some certainty over our reaction to uncertain events. So my suggestion would be, to think about perhaps three different sort of scenarios. One, best case scenario, perhaps maybe, six weeks now, whatever you're thinking, that actually there is some level of return to normality for your business. Yeah. There might be another one that's a couple of months later. And there might be another one that, you know, your worst case scenario at this point. I mean, I know that there are worst case scenarios than this. There are people dying in the world, but I'm just talking from a point of view that you may kind of consider, well, so what if therefore it's October or November or whatever? I mean, that would be obviously. And thinking about the different things that you would either have to do or not do within that period, for each one of those, and allowing you almost on a kind of decision tree basis, to consider what are the options you would take.
Yeah.
The other thing just to mention is, and somebody shared a quote with me, actually. I'm never one for a lot, you know, just quoting a lot of other people, but because I just think, but it's just a brilliant quote. And apparently it's a US Navy SEAL quote where somebody shared it with me the other day. It says that when the pressure is on, nobody rises to the occasion. They just fall to their baseline level of training.
Yeah.
So everybody falls to their baseline level of training, and whoever's baseline level of training was better, in theory, therefore, ultimately will be the ones that succeed. And I think it's because what it means is that we, when it therefore comes to it, if we've been doing the right things, then we don't, you know, we don't have to then sort of suddenly rise to an occasion or turn it on at that point in time.
Yeah.
Again, no. It's something that our manager at Burnley, Sean Dyche, uses quite a lot. That.
Yeah. Flick, do you want to?
Yeah, sure. So I think I'm just really interested in something that you said earlier around actually your dad constantly watching the news and all of that stuff, and how that can be quite negative and something that doesn't help with authentic optimism. But on the switch side of that, is there actually a danger of being too optimistic in this time period? Obviously, it is a very difficult and challenging time. And if we're too optimistic, do we risk slipping into kind of unhealthy denial?
So it comes back a little bit to that concept of the Stockdale paradox, where you've got to think about the potential facts and the potential hurdles that might be in the way. Because if you don't consider them in an optimistic way, in terms of making them more specific, making them controllable, and thinking about the fact that with certain action you will be able to overcome them, so they're also temporary, which again comes back to people's work in the field, then the likelihood is it'll be those things that actually get in the way. So a lot of people talk about, you've got to, you know, you, and we mentioned before, you know, having a really clear picture of the future is to, you know, in terms of in its ideal state. But if you don't consider the hurdles that are going to get in the way of that potentially, then it's, you know, statistically speaking, it'd be much less likely that you're actually going to be able to achieve that. So at considering the hurdles and thinking about what could potentially scupper those plans, what could potentially get in the way, is a really important part of the process of making sure that you're putting the right things in place to be able to overcome them if and when they do happen. So, but that's not going so far as catastrophizing about them. It's not going so far as, you know, seeing them as that they're an unbreakable force and we can't overcome them. Mm-hmm. So again, kind of coming back and away from false optimism, it's an interesting one because there's something called doublethink that I've come across within sport is that, you know, it's an interesting little, it's not a riddle, there's not really an answer to it. There are methods, but there's not really an answer right now. But, you know, a football team or a rugby team or a golfer who's about to hit a particular, you know, a putt maybe, you know, they have to believe 100% that they're going to put the ball in the hole, or they're going to, or they have to believe 100% that they can win that game, right? But at the same time, does a football team or a golfer or whoever it might be really believe that they are going to hole every single putt that they ever take, or that they're going to win every single game that they ever play? And the realistic view on that would probably be, well, no, right? There's only ever been two invincible teams. You know, unfortunately, Liverpool didn't do it this year to become the third one. I know, Brendan, that was frustrating for you. But actually, it's one of my home teams, Preston North End, that was the original invincibles. So just get that in there. But the idea that that you have to sort of hold these two thoughts at the same time, that I have to fundamentally believe that I can achieve something, but at the same time know that there may well be hurdles that would get in the way and that I'm probably not going to achieve it every single time. So it's kind of this balancing act between these two thought processes. But there's a good degree of logic in that, I think.
I was going to suggest we maybe take a couple of the questions that we've got from the audience. So one is from Charles, and he has asked, you know, he often talks about entrepreneurs should hope for the best and assume for the worst. Is that a good attitude as far as being authentically optimistic?
I think as long as when you're assuming for the, it depends what you mean, but when you assume the worst, it's not therefore in a way that assumes therefore that is going to happen. It's about a planning process, and I'm sure that's what Charles means by that. So I would absolutely agree with it. But I think it's more a case of,
which he does
coming back to in assuming the worst. What we're trying to do is it's a great way of thinking about it. Nice little soundbite in terms of how to process that information. And as long as on the other side of the equation as well, when we're hoping for the best, that's a genuine belief that is possible, as opposed to, you know, I could fantasize about achieving X, Y, or Z or whatever. As long as it's a genuine belief and not a fantasy, that's why, you know, the process of visualization is there's a way of going about visualizing an end result that is also authentic.
Yeah.
You know, seeing myself achieving something that actually, when I really think about it,
we've probably all, I'm sure anyone who's worked in business for a length of time has been part of like discussions talking about objectives for the year, and you've thought, that's not going to happen. You know, like, you know, they've been delivered in a really passionate way, but they've actually just not been grounded in reality.
Yeah, and I think there's for a business especially, and also within sport actually, and the way that goals are set, I see it often that you know, a target is cascaded down, and if there's some purpose in that, if there's some methodology in that where people can see the logical sense as to how that number has come about, absolutely, it makes sense, it makes logical sense, so therefore I can engage with it. If it just feels like a number's been plucked out of the air, then how can I engage with it as an individual? If I don't believe in it,
and
perception drives behavior, and so therefore if it doesn't drive my behavior because I just feel it's impossible, that's a fixed mindset. So coming back to growth versus fixed mindset. So my fixed mindset tells me if I can't, and where Carol Dweck's work comes in, if I can't complete the jigsaw puzzle, there's no point in putting the work in. That's what a child with a fixed mindset will do. It's the same with a sales target. Well, if I don't think I'm going to hit it, what's the point in putting effort in? You know, there's no point anyway, because I'm not going to get the reward. I'm not going to get the praise if I don't actually hit the number. So it's really important, I think, that process of making sure that those targets are in some way it believable and logical to people.
Yeah. Flick.
Yeah, and so we have another question from Tom, who asks, firstly, have you watched Sunderland Till I Die on Netflix?
I haven't actually. I'm going to. I'll always be honest, and I haven't. I know that I should, just because of the nature of the work that I'm involved in. But no, I haven't watched it first. But I'm intrigued about the next question then.
Well, he says that he asks in relation to what your advice would be to a football team in a relegation battle, and whether that would be similar to that that you'd give to a struggling business.
I think the second part of the question, I think it probably is similar. There tends to, pressure is subjective. So some people would say, oh no, there's more pressure in a relegation battle. Mm. But if you own a business and, you feel like it's, kind of falling down around you because there are certain things that are, not happening, you're putting everything in, then wow, that's pressure as well. Because how am I going to feed my family or whatever? Or whether you own a business or not, if you work for a business and you don't have to own it, of course not. So I think it is a similar situation, because pressure is just subjective and stress is subjective. I think the key thing is on with regards to it is that the principles of human performance are the same, no matter what the context is. So whether it's elite athletes, or whether it's salespeople, or whether it's people in operations, or whether it's whatever function it might be within a business, or whether it's pharmaceuticals or retail or people who work in government or the NHS, the principles of human performance are the same. It's the context that is different. Mm. So whilst you might talk about some of very similar principles in terms of, right, growth mindset, being authentic about the challenge, we've also got within a group, we would talk a lot about the ability to be able to actually have really honest conversations within that. Because if you're not actually dealing with the challenges, coming back to within a group format, so authentic optimism for oneself means I've got to deal with the brutal facts, because otherwise they're going to be the things that get in the way. For a group, in a group-based environment, you've got to be able to have some of those open conversations. You've got to be able another writer talks about, Patrick Lencioni, talk about being vulnerable. You've got to be able to be vulnerable to be able to actually talk about the things that actually are going wrong. Otherwise, we just never deal with the problems that face us as a group, whether that's a football team or whether that's a sales team. So I think as well as individually, there's also some collective stuff that we can do. And I would suggest that, yeah, there's just the context that's different, really.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Well, fantastic. Well, I think we've been going for... just over 45 minutes, which is the optimum time, I think, for, if people want to listen to this after we've been here together. And I think we've had a really good conversation. And thank you so much for Simon, for sharing your experience and some of the advice you've given. I think the thing I've really taken away from it is that, by actually really thinking about what we're going through at the moment and how we can be authentically optimistic and how we can kind of like try and apply that and plan for different scenarios and things, that we can come through this much stronger. And I think there's a real opportunity to, navigate this better than if we just kind of just let events take over our lives. So that's been really fantastic. So thank you. And so we're going to make this available for other people to listen via podcast. And then next week, we have our next event, which is going to be Navigating Uncharted Waters. And that's going to be with Stephen Kelly, who was he's the ex-CEO of Sage, Micro Focus, and Cordian. He's managed, several very successful turnarounds. He was even the COO of the UK government, and he's involved in about 20 different startups. So it's going to be really interesting to get that sort of CEO perspective on how to, we can sort of manage the current situation. And then for anyone who wants to, learn more about Simon's work, and as I say, I've had the pleasure of working with Simon a number of occasions over the last sort of 10 years. And I would, strongly recommend to check out his website, which is thinkworks.org.uk. And a great person for people both in support and business to talk to. So thank you, Simon. And thank
you're
you.
Welcome.
For
it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Simon. Thank you. And thank welcome you everybody who's joined live today. Great to see you all here, and hope to see you again next time.
Thank you.
Stay safe, everyone. Bye. Bye-bye.